Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is going to be MJ Network, as I said, in memory of my sister, Marcia Joyce, who started this me on this trail of doing radio shows, and I'm really glad she did. This is going to be kind of different. We're going to talk about what's happening right now in the schools and in the news. I am very lucky to have Alan Jacobson, who sits on safety committees in the college. I've sat on safety committees and headed one of my school, but I'm going to let him be the expert. And we have Michael Embry, who's going to talk about the media and their part in this, because this is really a powerful show. At the end, we might even just talk about, I took a poll this morning. I did. I was walking into several businesses, and I actually asked people that I didn't know on the street and people that I did know what they think about guns in the classroom. And we'll talk about that at the end. I have my own. I never give my opinion, but I do have mine as an educator. So, Alan, you sat on, say, the safety committee of a college. What do you think are the components that go into making a proper safety plan?
Well, there's a lot to it, Fran, but there are some basic baseline components. First and foremost, you need a vulnerability assessment by somebody who knows what they're doing to walk the campus, point out those things that are vulnerabilities, weaknesses, problems should an incident occur, and then draft a report with an action item list of things that need to be addressed. Once you have that, you could then turn your attentions and fundraising, because it's not going to be inexpensive, to address them. And that will lead to establishing a safety plan. And a safety plan is a comprehensive analysis of and outline of who does what when something or someone is identified as a threat, who is notified and when, and who is the incident commander, so to speak, who is a person on staff that everything funnels into, who's the quarterback in determining what needs to be done and when, and following the checklist of the plan that you have outlined. And then, as I said, you start installing whatever equipment is needed. That could be anything as simple as locks on all the doors of the classrooms and staff rooms, so that when you need to go into a situation, a lockdown, as it's called, all the doors can be closed or are closed and locked from the outside so that nobody can enter. And then if you have windows in the doors, then those windows need to have some facility for closing so that an offender who is on campus cannot see in. That's very important. The blinder he is, the better. If his intent is to cause harm and murder people and he's looking for people and he can't see who's in the room, he knows he has a limited amount of time to cause his damage, so that will slow him down and certainly frustrate his efforts to cause harm. And then training is is as important as having a plan, because if you drop a plan and have it, and nobody trains to it, then when an incident occurs or a threat occurs, you don't know what you're doing. Yeah, everybody, it's as if you didn't have the plan, because people are going like, oh, that's right, we have a plan. What am I supposed to do again? Who do I call? How do I? So you have to have training on a regular basis for the different scenarios that you've outlined and that you've strategized against. So that's a basic outline of what should be done. There's more to it, but that's a concept.
We had that in my school, and I realized that part of the problem that we had was when an intruder came in is that there are too many exits and too many entrances to the school, and that sometimes when children were out to lunch or outside playing, there were too many ways for people to get in. Also, I worked in a tough school in the Bronx, and we didn't have metal detectors, at all. So is there a way that when they have, I know this is going to sound crazy, the doors in a school, there's no way to automatically lock them all at one time?
I believe it can be done. You know, everything is a function of money. Almost anything could be done, but you're right. I mean, layout, the number of exits, the locations of the exits are all problematic, and they have to be dealt with. And sometimes you do need to reconfigure the layout of how your campus is configured, but sometimes that's just not practical. And some offenders know this, and they case the place, and they spend some time in pre-operation strategizing. So they go to the site and they look, they see what the schedule is, when students, it doesn't have to be a college, it could be obviously a preschool, it could be a religious institution. I mean, all these are vulnerabilities. And they see when the people are outside. And in fact, there are some who will call in a bomb threat. So then what do you do when you have a bomb threat? Some people, you know, some plans may call for you to evacuate. So then you have everybody coming out, and you've done his job for him. You're now putting everybody outside. You could have a situation where he is able to target shoot with a rifle. So, yeah, there's no perfect solution. There's nothing. If somebody, as in any case, and this goes in any criminal enterprise, if somebody is motivated enough and smart enough and collateralized enough to do harm, it's going to happen. So you have to either, perhaps the most effective way to deal with this is to develop a threat assessment plan. And this is something that the FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit has worked on in terms of setting parameters for what threat assessments should, I mean, that's what they do. That's part of what they do. And they have studied, along with other law enforcement agencies and psychologists and other disciplines, in terms of who should be conducting threat assessments in the local community, how it should be done. And because if you can identify the individuals who are at risk of going off and causing damage and mass murder, then you can often stop it before it happens. Because
well,
we had
some incidents like that in my school that were scary. We did have a bomb threat, and we did have to evacuate, and it was one of the teachers that called in the bomb threat. And there was actually a bomb in the school. She put something in one of the fourth grade classes because she didn't like the teacher. And that actually the whole, we were lucky it was only two classrooms that blew up. And we got outside. We were lucky. We had to be outside with no coats in 20-degree weather, freezing. But it was either that or we didn't know. And they knew who did it. And she called it in. But what's to stop? You know, open school night is coming next Monday. My friends invited me to come back to the school to see them, and I said, no, I'll pass on that. That's okay. What's to stop a parent from coming in on open school night angry? I mean, the guards are there.
Well,
do you think about that? I mean, what do you do?
So this is where the threat assessment concept comes into play, because these are not sometimes the media, and Michael can get into this later, but sometimes the media will use terms and terminology as, you know, oh, he snapped, and you know, he all of a sudden, you know, he's taking his gun and going out and killing scores of people. No, these offenders don't snap. These are targeted, planned attacks. They decide that they're going to do this, and often they tell people, they telegraph what they're going to do. I think the statistics are 70% tell at least one person and 50-something percent tell at least two people. And the issue is that when conducting these threat assessments, it's having access. It's having those people come forward and notifying whether it be law enforcement or school administration or a friend or a neighbor, and they'll say something like, you know, I'm concerned about John. He's made these comments about going mm-hmm. into the school and just, you know, taking out XYZ. And, you know, these things have to be taken seriously, and it's better to be safer and report it and perhaps be wrong than to say, oh, my God, he told me he was going to do something. I should have said something. I didn't take it seriously, or I felt foolish making the call. I didn't want to cry wolf. I mean, it's human nature not to want to say something, but the single mm-hmm. most important thing that the behavioral analysis unit has found in a threat assessment is bystander participation, because they are, you know, we hear it now in airports and public places. When you see something, say something. That's the mm-hmm. concept of bystander, the army of bystanders helping out law enforcement in terms of keying them in to potential threats. Then you can have the proper individual, whether it be a social worker or a school administrator or law enforcement, or, you know, so there are avenues to address such a threat if you know about it in advance. That's mm-hmm. where what they call upstanders, and those are basically bystanders that come forward with information and take the, quote, risk to their reputation if they're wrong, but they also get the benefits of being basically a hero, of saving lives if they're right in reporting the information to a person of power. Now, that's not perfect, because as we've mm-hmm. seen, sometimes upstanders do what they're supposed to do, and the people who are receiving the potential threat don't do what they're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. And you know, so the system can break down, but nothing happens if you don't have these upstanders that that come forward. And
do they sometimes think that when they get this threat that it's just a prank or something? And that's what worries
well,
me, because you have to take everything seriously. I mean, we had a whole bunch of them. I had an incident. This was really the last principal of my school. I can't believe that she's still there. We had a child that took a gun away from a police officer on election day, and I was the dean, and she asked me to go down, and I didn't know that this kid had a gun in his hand pointed at the police officer, and I had to actually say to him, you need to put the gun down. You're going to be suspended. If you don't want to be arrested on the spot, you need to put the gun down. You don't want to hurt anybody. I just wanted to see if I could do it. I said, you know, I'm not laughing. And you know how scary that was? Because she was afraid to go near him, and I had to stop him from shooting the police officer. And I looked at the police officer and go, how did you lose the gun in your holster? I don't know. I said, how could you not know? It was lucky that the safety was on. I mean, these things, and I was lucky because I was like, my heart was palpitating. I'm going, Omar, I'm going to get, oh, my God. And he looked at me, the kid, he says, you're going to get me. I said, no, you're going to be suspended. If you put the gun down, maybe the officer won't arrest you like you should be. I mean, right. What type of training is needed for administrators and students that would protect somebody? I mean, I was the dean, and I was told that if I saw a fight, I had to break it up. And I'm little. You know I'm little. And there were teachers in my school that were black belts in karate, and they gave me lessons on how to stop a fight without getting hurt. I usually did get hurt, but it wasn't because somebody tried to hurt me. So what kind of training do you need to do for kids, for teachers, so that you see something? And what would happen, let's say you said, you know, somebody has to say something. I get that. But what happens if it's two kids and it's their friend and he doesn't want to rent them out?
Well, that's the problem. That's the barrier, one of the barriers to a bystander becoming an upstander. It's that it's that human nature aspect of, well, I don't want to say anything against my friend. I mean, what if, you know, he's just talking? What if it's just talk? And, you know, that's the issue, is that the average person is not trained to recognize what a threat is, when a threat is legitimate and when it's not. But that's where you have to teach people that hey, you know what? You are not the one that has to decide whether something is legitimate or not. All you have to do is let the proper people know. And if it turns out that it's not an issue, then fine. But what if it is an issue and that person goes on and murders even one person is too many? So that has to be, you know, and again, this is human nature, not to want to come forward out of concern for being admonished because you pulled, you know, you cried wolf, or you wasted somebody's time. Police chiefs will tell you, look, if you see something that's not right, call 911. That's our job.
Yeah.
Our job is to be there and respond. And if it turns out to be nothing, hey, we're happy. That's a great outcome. But if it turns out to be something, we're doing our job to be there to take care of it. So it is very hard to make that 911 call. I have made them in the past, and I felt good about making them. But it's hard to pick up the phone and say, I am going to call the police, because that's, we know, that sets in motion a series of incidents, which it's kind of a big deal. But at the same time, if you don't make that call, could be a much bigger deal where people die, and that is just not acceptable. So it's a matter of, and that this is where the media could come in terms of educating people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mike, have you ever gotten a phone call from, has the media ever gotten, the newspaper ever gotten a phone call about a death by the threat?
I'm sorry, is that to me?
Yes.
Yeah, uh-huh. Has the media ever gotten a phone call? How would you deal with that? What should the media do in order to temper this or so that people don't get scared?
I mean, if you mean if they initially got a phone call, I would think most reputable news organizations would notify law enforcement and then dispatch the reporters to cover the event. The thing right now is that the media has changed so much in the past 20 years with social media and, you know, things like Twitter and bloggers. And the mainstream media, for the most part, is still, you know, reputable. They'll fact check and do things like that, although they do, you know, err at times. But most media will, at least when I was with the Associated Press and newspapers, we would try to be diligent about it all and be fair and not, you know, try not to create panic. Of course, you know, in our nation, you know, free press is important, and I have three grandchildren, and in fact, I have a son who's a para educator and a daughter-in-law who's a teacher, and if there was an incident of gun violence at one of their schools, I would want to know. I wouldn't want the media to cover it up or anything. I would like to be informed that, you know, what is going on, but I don't. I think a problem is that a lot of times you have this everybody weighing in on what happened, you know, and instead of giving it some analysis and you know, deep analysis, instead of, you know, coming back with responses, you know, 1 hour after an incident. But it's something you have to weigh, and as Alan said, and as you know, as a teacher, everything's a little bit different, so you have to approach it, each one differently.
It's scary. My niece, well, my family lives in Parkland, and my niece's school the next day was locked down. You must have read about the police officer that accidentally shot himself. And his gun went off, and my niece's school was locked down. She said they were trained, though. The kids knew what to do, to go under the desk, to lie on the floor. It was horrible. The next day, my another niece texted me. She said, we have a code black. We have a bomb threat. And do you know what happened? Because of this, every morning I check them at 7:30. Are you okay? If you see something, say something. If you can't get in touch with your parents, you call me, and I'll call 911 from New York. It's frightening. So why are so many schools advocating that staff and administrators carry weapons This is a touchy question. And I actually, like I said to Mike and Alan, I did a poll this morning of about 20 people. Seriously? I got mixed reviews. Some people actually felt that the teachers and guards should wear vests, I don't know why, and should have guns and should be trained. Some people said, well, what about the students in vests? And some people say it would make it worse. I don't know. What do you think?
Well,
I have my own opinion, and I'll keep it to myself.
I think this is largely, this is, tread lightly territory, because the Second Amendment is a very controversial and polarizing issue. And as you know, Fran, for my novel, Hard Target, I researched the Second Amendment. I spoke with experts all over D.C. about this. And, you know, the bottom line is a handgun or a rifle, a firearm, is a very potent weapon. And how we as human beings react in the heat of the moment is, I would say, predictable by those who understand the human psyche, but unpredictable if you're the person wielding the weapon and faced with a threat. And this is where training comes into play. You have to, as a police officer, as anybody who carries a weapon, or a soldier, whoever is carrying a loaded weapon, has to go through intensive training to learn how to use the weapon, how to handle the weapon, how to hold the weapon, how to point the weapon when it's not being used, where to put your finger. These are drills. Officers go through, shooting houses where they're faced with threats, and you react. And if you do the wrong thing, you're gonna discharge your weapon, and very likely at the wrong place, at the wrong moment, and hurt somebody or kill someone. Police officers go through regular training to make sure that when the time comes, they're going to do the right thing, not by thinking, but by instinct. If you have to think, it may be too late. So it's the kind of thing where I am not in favor of teachers carrying weapons, because teachers have enough on their plates to teach our children. And that requires hours beyond the hours they're being paid for. So to ask them now to go through training to carry weapons and use weapons in cases of extreme stress and threat, it can't be fit into the schedule properly, which means you're not going to have people carrying weapons that are trained properly. When you and this brings back a conversation I had with a friend of mine who's an OBGYN. And he delivers, as you can imagine, babies at all times of the night, and sometimes he's in not-so-good neighborhoods at 3, 4 in the morning. So he got a concealed carry permit, and he's a gun aficionado. He likes target shooting. So he got a concealed carry permit, and to get one of those, you have to go through training, as what I described. The type of threat assessment in split seconds. You know, somebody suddenly pops into your field of view and you discharge your weapon because it's a threat. Well, no, it wasn't a threat. Mm-hmm. It was a woman holding her baby. But in the heat of the moment, when physiologically the visual field narrows and your breathing becomes short and your heart is pumping faster, you're not prepared to make such split-second decisions if you don't have adequate training on a regular basis. And what he told me is that he started asking himself, if I'm in a bank and there's a bank robbery and I have my weapon on me, am I prepared to pull it to use it? And this is somebody who loves guns and loves shooting and has gone through all the training. And what he concluded was, No. He would not want to pull the weapon because a few things happen. Number one, he's immediately responsible for all the lives and for the life of the perpetrator. He has to then make split-second decisions, and he is calling himself out as the threat. He is now the threat, the prime threat to the offender.
Mm-hmm.
Because nobody can hurt the offender if they're keeping their distance, right? But the guy with the gun who's across the room, who doesn't have to be within his, you know, within reach to stop the offender. So he is now the prime target. And did he want to be that person? So these are all things that he, as an individual who is trained in concealed carry, in all the scenarios, he's gone through the training on a regular basis as to who to shoot, when. Instinctually, he theoretically knows how to do it. But the fact of the matter is that as human beings, we don't know how we're going to react when things come down, when things happen. When that threat hits, when that moment comes, how are you going to react? And as
I
we all know,
you.
In Parkland, you had the deputy standing outside, hearing the gunshots inside, and not going in. I mean,
I read something about that they were told to stay outside by their head person, that she said not to go inside. Is that true? Because I read something, I read an article on that yesterday. I was like, oh, my God, she told them to stay outside.
What I've heard, and I did not read this yesterday, so more information could have become available since I read what I read. But I heard that he was telling others who responded not to go inside. And then I heard that he said that he thought the shooting was coming from outside, so he didn't see a need to go inside. I mean, look, you know, it's embarrassing. Deeply embarrassing is the kind of stain that never goes away. Your name is forever associated with being a coward, with contributing to the murder of over a dozen innocent children. So, you know, you're gonna say what you need to say. So the fact is, do I believe him? No. And you know, Fran, I'm very pro-law enforcement. And when I read it made me sick. And I'm sure just about every other police officer felt the same way. That's not what they're there for. They train, they spend their entire careers ready to go in and confront an armed offender. That's their job. And I think probably 99.9 out of 100 would go in there and do their job and take care of the offender. This guy didn't. And because of that, a lot of people died. And That's a tragedy on top of a tragedy. But, you know, these things, the Second Amendment is a very touchy situation. I think there are things that can be done, but they, you know, it's a common sense type approach. And the problem, quite frankly, is politics. When you bring politics into a common sense problem, the common sense goes out the window and you just have a problem. I mean, being succinct about it, that's what it is, because you have interests that have nothing to do with what makes sense, and instead you have one side, you know, pushing their agenda over the facts. And look, I'm not against guns. I'm not somebody who says you need to abolish the Second Amendment, but I do think there needs to be common sense controls in place. There's a video out there of a young person. I don't remember how old he is, 13 or 15, who goes and buys an AR-15, and he's not asked for identification to show how old he is. He literally has sold the gun, but then he goes into a liquor store and he's carded because he's not old enough. So, you know, the point of the video was there's the system is not working, and you know, so let's look at this for a second. You've got a very common weapon, the AR-15, that's being used in almost all, or let's just say a lot of, a predominance of these mass murders. And you've got machine guns, which are even more lethal and effective if you're the offender, and they're not being used for these attacks. So let's ask ourselves, why is that the case? Machine guns are not outlawed, but the key is they're more highly regulated and restricted. So it's much more difficult for someone to walk in and buy a machine gun than it is an AR-15. So why not, again, here's the common sense part, why not apply the same restrictions to AR-15s that you're applying to machine guns? Well, one argument is, well, okay, an AR-15 is no different from a handgun. It just fires more rounds and does it more quickly. So let's examine that for a minute, because I've heard that so many times from people that I've spoken with. And I want to read you and paraphrase a short excerpt from an article written by an emergency department physician, Dr. Heather Scher, who's in Florida. And this was published in The Atlantic. So anybody who wants to read the full article, I recommend it. It was an eye-opener for me, and I know about this stuff, but it spoke to me as well, because, as you know, I was a chiropractic physician before I became a novelist. And let me just read you this, because it laid it out very clearly. Routine handgun injuries leave entry and exit wounds and linear tracks through the victim's body that are roughly the size of the bullet. If the bullet does not directly hit something crucial like the heart or the aorta, and the victim does not bleed to death before being transported to the trauma center, chances are that he can be saved. The bullets fired by an AR-15 are different. They travel at a higher velocity and are far more lethal than routine bullets fired from a handgun. The damage they cause is a function of the energy they impart as they pass through the body. A typical AR-15 bullet leaves the barrel traveling almost three times faster and imparting more than three times the energy of a typical 9mm bullet fired from a handgun. An AR-15 rifle outfitted with a magazine with 50 rounds allows many more lethal bullets to be delivered quickly without reloading. The tissue, soft tissue next to the bullet, is elastic, so it moves away from the bullet like waves of water displaced by a boat, and then it returns and settles back. This is a process called cavitation. It leaves the displaced tissue damaged or killed. The high-velocity bullet fired from an AR-15 causes a swath of tissue damage that extends several inches from its path. It does not have to actually hit an artery to damage it and cause catastrophic bleeding. Exit wounds, remember the exit wounds from a regular bullet, 9mm, the size of a, roughly the size of the bullet. Well, from an AR-15, the exit wounds can be the size of an orange. With an AR-15, the shooter does not have to be particularly accurate. It's not a matter of the victim being unlucky. If a victim takes a direct hit to the liver from an AR-15, the damage is far graver than that of a simple handgun shot injury. Handgun injuries to the liver are generally survivable unless it hits the organ's main blood supply. An AR-15 bullet wound to the middle of the liver would cause so much bleeding that the patient would never make it to the trauma center alive.
Do you think Nicholas Cruz knew that? Do you think he knew that when he bought that gun? He's crazy. I know. And then they said that he was mentally disturbed, and part of it is the school's fault. Part of it is the psychiatric care's fault. And he was smart, because he waited till dismissal time, so the kids were coming out, and he just walked right in. That's what's even scarier.
Well, he was an insider, so he... Yeah, go ahead, Michael.
Michael, what do you think?
No, I was going to say, I think, a point that Alan's making, it's just simply the access to AR-15s and semi-automatic weapons. You know, there have been school shootings in our country for 200 years, probably. You know, and there were quite a few back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. But once they started using the semi-automatic weapons, that's when you started having the mass killings. Before, you'd have maybe a teacher or a couple students killed with a handgun or whatever. And but now you have what we had at Virginia Tech, what we had at Sandy Hook and other places. So it's as Alan said, you know, the same kid can go into a liquor store and will be carded and can't buy a beer, but he can go off into a gun place and pick up an AR-15. I mean, it defies logic really for me. It's just I don't understand it.
Do they have these? I mean, they have gun shows where you can buy anything. I don't even think they were doing a background check, because my sister's, whatever you want to call him, ex-husband, whatever, has a whole slew of rifles at home. I mean, you don't need to have any kind of thing for a rifle. I mean, anybody could get sort of anything. It's like you go to a gun show, you go to a gun range. I mean, my sister said to me, did I ever want to go learn how to shoot a gun? I go, not particularly, no. And my brother-in-law wanted to take me with him to the gun range, and I go, I don't ever want to touch a weapon. That would be horrible. I mean, so it's such easy access, and this kid just, he knew what he was doing. So what can be, I read something this morning, and Google sends me everything, that somebody said that the best way to do this would be to repeal the Second Amendment. I don't know if that would be the answer. But
well,
and then somebody, that's an interesting point. Would you repeal the Second Amendment?
It's also a non-starter. Number one, that would never happen.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, the Second Amendment is a hot button, and there are people who are so fervently opposed to any kind of gun control that that's where you have the politics entering into the equation. Because if this were a normal situation and a politician saw the mass murder that occurred in his state, of course any common sense politician is going to say we need better laws to address this. Instead, what you have are politicians who are afraid to take a stance against restrictions on gun ownership, even if it's common sense. Where, okay, gun shows, you know what? Just like there are background checks when you walk into a gun shop, there should be background checks when you walk into a gun show. But it, you know, the politics get in the way, and they're afraid of voters, or they themselves are of the opinion that, you know, I love guns and we should all be allowed to have guns because, you know, that's what the Second Amendment provides for. And you know, as in so many things that don't make sense in government, this is one of those where you can't even arrive at a common sense approach to protecting young people or just innocent people, plain, period, you know, from someone who wants to do mass murder. And, you know, again, I'm not against gun ownership, but I'm for responsible gun ownership, and there's a difference.
Well, Alan, I was going to add, too, I think the latest poll I read is that 80% of Americans want responsible gun ownership. They think there should be some restrictions on who can, you know, what kind of guns people can own. And but again, you know, the politics enters the equation, and things go askew. And
that's the problem. That's, you know, and yeah, it's a big problem because we all know that anytime you have polarizing views, the best method is, in my opinion, compromise, and you reach sensible solutions. Mm. And too often, in fact, you know, more often the past 12 to 15 years, if not a little bit longer, we've lost the ability to compromise in government. So we have, you know, whoever is in power at the time makes the rules. And that's not always what's best for society. In fact, I would argue either extreme is not good. You need compromise.
Well, I read something else. I'm reading. I did a lot of research, so I would know what I was saying today. There was a principal in Texas who threatened to suspend students who protest for stopping gun violence. There was another incident at the Frederick Douglass School where there was a student in the classroom that was playing with a gun and shot himself because they didn't have metal detectors, they had a metal wand. And what got me was that when I listened to the principal and the school officials say, well, nobody else got hurt, they suspended him because they were forced to, but not because they thought he did anything wrong. What was he doing there? What was your sense? I mean, I don't understand why anyone in their right mind would say it's not a big deal. And why would this principal threaten to suspend students who wanted to stop gun violence?
Well,
that bothers me. I mean, I look at these kids in Parkland. They're speaking out.
Yes. And you know what? That's what this country is about. Because if you respect the Second Amendment, then you have to respect the First Amendment. And these students, they're the next generation. And
yeah, they're good.
This is what you want from your next generation of leaders. And, you know, I think that what organizations like the NRA have to realize is that, you know, it's going to hit a tipping point. And if these mass murders continue to happen, and look, nobody can predict the future, but if you look at the pattern of what's been happening and where society is headed, and it's not in a positive direction, if you ask me, and I think if you ask most people, this is not going to stop. So then you have to be the adult in the room and say, okay, this is a problem and it needs to be addressed. And arming staff, as I said, who are ill-equipped to deal with this is not going to be the solution. And, I'm concerned. I don't see common sense approaches. I see political solutions, not common sense solutions. And I think anytime you inject politics into a situation, you're not going to end up with a balanced solution. You're going to end up with one extreme or the other. And as I said, in my opinion, either extreme is a poor solution.
One thing I read, I thought was rather interesting, by having armed guards and armed teachers, we're really not sending our kids to schools. We're sending them to detention centers, and that's not what schools should be about. Schools should be learning, and it should be open. And but taking the extreme measures of wanting to arm a first grade teacher or eighth grade middle class teacher or a middle school teacher, I really don't see how that's a solution to any of that. To me, it only exacerbates and makes things worse. You know, what about the scenario where there's a teacher who just totally fed up with the students and the teacher's mentally ill? Because we know there are mentally ill teachers. Mentally ill people in all professions. And let's say he goes off and some kid talks back to him and he pulls out his gun and, you know, threatens him. And that, I can see that scenario happening. I just don't. Teachers have too much, as Alan said, have too much on their plates. I mean, with teaching and the homework and doing all the other things that teachers do. I mean, they're wonderful people, and let's let them stay focused on educating our children.
I agree with you, because for 36 years, it's funny, I never had a worry. I guess I was very lucky because they did have detention centers, and I disagreed with them. They had what we had in the school. Howard Levy took away the fact that you can send children home to suspend them. They relaxed that in the sense if you bring a weapon or, God forbid, something like that, they get suspended. They used to suspend them for a fight. They don't do that anymore. Some schools have suspension centers where you actually, and I know because I had to do it, sit with the children that got in trouble, and that makes it even more difficult, these detention centers. But, you know, it's funny. For 36 years, I never thought about going into a school and being afraid. And I taught in a bad, tough school in the Bronx, and they just sort of like, don't start with her. I don't think I'd ever want to walk into a school and have to worry that I had to bring a gun. So, Alan, you're in for this. I'm like, what can parents teachers and administrators do, and law enforcement do, to work together to prevent something like this from happening? And if there's an action plan or a safety plan, should the police department be in on it, and should every school have the same type of plan?
Absolutely, law enforcement should be in on it. This is something that needs to be a coordinated effort mm-hmm. with your local mm-hmm. law enforcement and even fire department, because mm-hmm. you know, there these things are. So let's take a scenario where you have a bomb threat, or you have
mm-hmm.
a targeted attack, or even just the threat of a targeted attack. Law enforcement definitely needs to be notified, but you need to know who to call. You know, if you need to know who to call, what to say, because
mm-hmm.
seconds count. And if you're properly trained, you have the phone call at your the phone number at your fingertips. You know what to say, what information to provide, and then law enforcement knows, because they've been to your site, they've walked it with you, they know who's in charge, they know approximately where the buildings are located. They can go, and they are going to rely on the administrators to direct them. And give them information, because they're coming onto the site and they only know what you tell them. So this is a coordinated effort with local
mm-hmm.
law enforcement and your staff at the school. That's what I'm talking about with training. You have to train
yeah.
for the plan. And it's not enough to have the plan. You have to train to the plan on a regular basis, so that if it happens, you're not sitting there thinking or looking things up on your phone or your computer.
Mm-hmm.
You're reacting because you know. You've been through it. You've done the drills. Kind of like the fire drills, you know. I remember as a kid.
Yeah, I remember fire drills.
You know, everybody out. They know where to go. They line up. You know, you do it regularly so you know what has to happen without having to say, wait, what am I supposed to – that's a bell. What does that bell mean? No, you know immediately what it is. So that's the kind of training that needs to be done. And yes, absolutely needs to be coordinated with law enforcement. Each facility is different. So to answer your
mm-hmm.
question, not all plans are the same, but the concept
mm-hmm.
behind the plan are the same.
Yeah.
So conceptually, yes, you could say there's a blueprint, but there are nuances with local law enforcement. Some are going to have much larger departments. Sometimes you're dealing with the sheriff department instead of
mm-hmm.
police department, but bottom line is, conceptually, there's a blueprint.
Well, you know something, when I taught, some of the rooms, when I first taught, they didn't have intercom phones in the school. In some of the rooms I had, when I had some hairy situations, it was a good thing that I had a cell phone. I'm just wondering if there could be, if the teachers should have, even if it's in the top drawer of their desk, some kind of card that has the numbers as to what to call. Or maybe they should definitely have the police department, the fire department, right on their cell phone so they can call. Or if they're supposed to call down to the office, they know who to call. I mean, at the tip of their tongue. And the children should know how to train themselves. I mean, I saw something on Israel last week on I-24. The children are being trained for aerial and drone attacks. They know what to do. The kids in Parkland knew what to do. I mean,
yeah.
Unfortunately, 17 children died, and my friend's granddaughter died. And that Guttenberg was her, was the child, Jamie Guttenberg. So, like, how could the media have dealt differently with this? Did they make it worse by, you know, each reporter is different, so how could they have done something different?
Well, Michael, you take that first, and then I have something to add after.
I'm coming up
yes,
with these things out of nowhere,
difficult.
People.
I was reading a piece by a guy named therapist, psychologist, James O'Granny, and he's pretty critical of the media, and he considers a lot of these shootings as being kind of contagious. They call it a contagion, that something happens and, you know, the kids read about it. Hey, I'm going to follow up, and I'm going to see if I can top that. In fact, even a couple of weeks after the Parkland shootings, there was a See Something, Say Something incident where some people reported a young young man in California, and they discovered that he had a cache of weapons, and he was going to, his plan was to top, you know, the 17 that were killed in Parkland. But I digressed there a little bit. But one thing he said that the media should do, what they're doing wrong, is that, you know, they name the shooter, they described his characteristics, they detailed the crime, they numbered the victims, and these are all the things that that I guess the media should be doing. But then they ranked him against other successful attackers. So it almost puts you, you know, it glorifies or gives this person 15 minutes of fame or whatever. And Anderson Cooper a few years ago, after one of the shootings, he said, we're going to mention the shooter's name a couple times, but after that we're not going to mention who perpetrated all this. We're going to, because it's really not fair to the victims. We don't sit there and name all the victims, and generally the media will wait until they have a list until it's all verified. That's one reason why it takes a while for that to happen anyway. But he thought out of fairness to the victims and not to glorify somebody who kills 10, 15, 20 people, not to mention their names. I think it's one thing the media can do, and I think they should also quit trying to rush to judgment on things or with their analysis. Take time and talk to media, talk to people who study these things, and avoid parties who have a piece of the action. Such as the NRA and other groups. Look at it for what it is. You know, people are getting killed, families are being affected, and go from there. Go ahead, Alan.
Why don't they want to do anything? Go on, Alan.
I agree with you 100%, Michael. In fact, The behavioral analysis unit goes a step further and says that media should stop using the terms active shooter or lone wolf, because these are romanticizing and idealizing these offenders. And they project power, they sensationalize predatory violence, and you don't want to give them anything where the next person says, "Well, I want to do that too. I'm mad at this individual who fired me, so I'm going to go in there and now everybody's going to know who I am, and they're going to know what they did to me, and my name's going to be all over the news, and I'm going to have videos, you know, on YouTube, name, you know, showing what I did forever. It's going to be up there." So you know, as Michael said, when you have extensive media coverage showing the offender's name and face and the life stories, and, you know, this only cements the legacies that these mass murderers are attempting to achieve. And, you know, that's why I've been using the term mass murderers, targeted attacks. Active shooter is a very bad term, lone wolf. And you know, other things that the media uses. So they really need to work to scrub those terms. And as Michael said, the way they approach it in terms of making these killers famous, that needs to stop. Will that change it completely? No. I mean, this is a multifaceted problem, but these are things that the media can do to help stem the tide to some extent, at least psychologically, because we know...
Well, before we end in 5 minutes, let me remind myself, I have a show on Monday, Murder Well-Timed, Watch Your Watches, people. On the 19th, I have another one. On the 21st, I'm really excited. He writes for Tom Clancy. Mark Cameron will be here. The Thursday is Look for Her, and Well-Timed Murder is the 19th. The 26th is someone you know, Alan, and I know quite well, Second Story Man, Charles Salzberg. On the 29th, I am doing the show in memory of my mom for Alzheimer's. I am very proud to say that my Alzheimer's Caregiver's Guide, I hope, will be out by then. It's for Alzheimer's, traumatic brain injury, and to make people aware, and I might actually do another, I'm doing a show on this, the 29th, on elder care abuse at nursing homes. And that's just some of what I'm up to. I really wonder, so before we end, if we have any closing remarks. I'm just hoping that this person, who I won't mention his name, actually pays for his crime, or are they going to put him someplace where, you know, because he's has a mental illness, and that bothers me too. And what would you think to that? What would you say as a final remarks about what should be done, and about these students that are speaking out? Good for them.
Well, I think, yes, good for them, for the students who are speaking out. We need more of that. That's what this country is all about. I'm not saying, you know, we should revert back to the 60s, but you need the voices, and you need more of that type of coverage than the coverage aggrandizing the offenders, the mass murderers. With each incident, unfortunately, we learn more about what to do and what not to do and how we could have prevented it. You know, that's a fact of life. It's not a positive, because each time you learn more, that means more people have been killed. And that's really unacceptable. Our society should be able to find solutions. We have the solutions. We're just too afraid to take them, and that's the unfortunate part. And in my opinion, as I said, in some, arming people who are ill-equipped to handle a firearm and won't have the time or disposition too. I mean, not everybody wants to hold a gun, let alone shoot one. I like shooting my gun. You know, other people, friends, don't even want to touch it. So you have to account for that difference in society. So, you know, when you're taking 100 teachers, you know, what if 80 don't want to touch it and the other 20 say, all right, this is my civic duty, I'll have to do it, this is what I'm being told, you know, is the best thing to do, I'll do it, I'll do my best. Well, doing your best, you're putting a loaded firearm in somebody's hands and telling them to do their best. No, I mean, this is not something you take lightly. A law enforcement officer of any stripe, they are going to be going through intensive training because they know what's at stake. And that's the way this needs to be handled. So if it means putting more armed personnel, whether it be police or properly trained security personnel on a campus, maybe that's the solution. Probably not. I think these other solutions are much more, you know, the threat assessment teams, the encouragement of bystanders to speak up when they hear something, because these murderers are planning. These are things that they're doing. They tell people. So it's the people who are being told who need to speak up and speak out and help, hopefully prevent through some intervention mass murder.
I agree with you. I agree with you. And if you see a package or you see something on the street, you're supposed to say something.
Absolutely.
It's scary. I have too, and it's scary because just that gun incident, and then we had a kid that came into school one day. We didn't have metal detectors in my school. I don't even know if they do now. But the junior high school across the street from where I used to live, a student was just, they were lucky they had metal detectors because the kid walked in with an unloaded gun or something like that, and he was going to use it to hit somebody over the head. I mean, it's frightening that teachers have to sit and worry about that. And some administrators, like I said, hide in their office and let you handle the problem and hope that you don't, you know, get panic. I had a student that came into school with a knife, and he said, here, I said, just hand it to me gently. Don't stick it in me. And I had to suspend him. He actually gave it to me. He told me he had it. There was a group of boys that came in from outside with machetes. I said, anybody particular you don't want today? Can I please have those? And I had to call the police. And it's scary. But I was never really afraid. I knew they weren't going to hurt me. At least I hope they didn't. But in 36 years, I never walked into that school and saying to myself, oh, my God, something's going to happen. And you never know when something's going to happen. But I want to thank both of you so much for today. Alan, when is your next book coming out, and how come I don't have it yet?
June 19th it comes out. I suspect the advanced reader copies will be coming out in the next month or so. It's awesome. It's called Dark Side of the Moon. It's fresh, original. Yeah, it is. I'm very, very excited about this book. Dark Side of the Moon, June 19th. And, of course, my website, alanjacobson.com.
I'm excited because I get to read it and before everybody else, I hope. I mean, seriously.
Michael,
when are you writing the next? When are you writing the next one? I have to know what happens to Brody.
I've written about 45,000-46,000 words. I'm about halfway through with it, and it'll probably come out this fall. And the tentative title is New Horizons, and the family faces some more crazy things with Brody and the mother-in-law and a few other things.
I'm excited. I'm taking my book that I wrote. It's in front of me. I just ordered a copy of my own book, Bertha Fights Back. And Bertha Fights Back is about exactly this, what happens in a school when something happens. And we did in my school, I was on the head of the committee for peer mediation, teaching children how to settle their arguments by talking without using their hands to fight. So I'm going to rewrite the book and make it a little bit more current, and I think I'm just going to call it Fighting Back. And I'm hoping that that'll come out in May or June, because I think that more schools need to know what to do when students need to handle arguments rather than fighting, how they can handle it through peer mediation. And it does work. Up until this last principal got there, it did work. And we had very few suspensions, and it did work. So I want to thank you both very, very much for today. The show is now live. I'm going to put out the link everywhere so that everybody that was listening on Facebook could hear it. And everybody, thank you so much. Alan, I can't wait to see you at the Thriller Fest. And if you want to set up an interview, just let me know for the new book, because, you know, you come first. I'll put you at the top of my huge pile. Okay, everybody, thank you. Have a great day.
Brian, can I
yes.
add one more thing?
Sure.
March 14th, it's a 17-minute walkout for each student and staff. That's going to be a nationwide thing. And March 24th, there's going to be a march in Washington, D.C. on school violence. So mark those dates.
You know, my niece's school was the school, North Broward Academy. They were the ones that did the Circle of Solidarity. And my niece was there, my cousins were there, and my niece's parents were there. Everybody was there. So they're going to be part of that march on the 24th, I guarantee. All of them walked out and walked to the Marjorie Storm School. It was amazing. So, yeah, we need to keep this alive, and we need to let people know that this has to be stopped, and they should. This is great that they are going to walk out. A whole bunch of schools have been doing that. As a matter of fact, my nephew's school in Cherry Hill walked out also, the same thing. Of course, the principal there didn't quite back them up, but what can I say? So, everybody, have a great day. The sun is shining. Mike, I hope you don't get too much snow tomorrow. And Alan, if you want to send some warmth here, we could use it. It's like 20 degrees outside, and the sun is shining, and I can't stand that. Thank you so much. Everybody have a great day, and bye.
Thank you, Alan.
Bye.